Welcome to Social Justice Matters, a podcast from Social Justice Ireland. I'm Eamon Murphy, Economic and Social Analyst at SGI. Our Social Justice Matters podcast comes in a few different formats. We'll be uploading interviews conducted on topical issues, and our 10-minute lessons are a series of short introductions to important policy areas. This episode is the fifth in our seminar series, where we publish some of the most important or relevant presentations from past Social Justice Ireland events. For this week's podcast, we're looking back to our 2018 Social Policy Conference and a presentation by Christine Bowen, Deputy Editor of the Journal, or Acting Editor as she was at the time. Christine's talk has additional relevance, given the times that we're in. While a workable coalition government is yet to be found and negotiated, the really important detail will be in the programme for government that gets negotiated after that. This is what will really matter when it comes to improving the lives of those of us living in Ireland. Christine's talk delved into what newsrooms and teach those who have to negotiate the next programme for government, including how to measure what's important, why it's important to have a good team around you, and how to measure what success looks like. Check back here for more episodes soon.
Thanks very much for having me here today. It's really an honour. I'm going to be talking about how we measure what's important, whether it's in a newsroom or in a country. I've been working in newsrooms for just over a decade now, and I've learned a lot of things in that time. I've learned not to read the comments. I've learned to get off Twitter. I've learned about the importance of having a good team around you because they're the people you're going to be seeing at 6:30 in the morning and 11 o'clock at night when you've got a breaking news story, and you need to be able to rely on them and you need to trust them and you need to be able to look at each other at those times of the day and night when it's an ungodly hour and you can rely on each other. And I've also learned how to measure what success looks like and that you can't over-rely on one metric and that you can't assume that just because you're getting bigger means that you're getting better. So I'm going to look at how we've learned that in newsrooms and apply that to the programme for government and to the country and what we can be learning from newsrooms. Because for a long time, Ireland, like a lot of other countries, has followed the model that growth is automatically good, which is something Sean touched on in the beginning there. And if the economy is growing, the idea is that all is well. And this has been baked into how we talk about the country. We saw it in Fine Gael's 2016 election slogan, the Keep the Recovery Going. We see it when the central bank issues its quarterly figures on economic growth every 3 months. The Minister for Finance frequently refers to it. He called economic growth the baseline scenario, which underpinned the budget for next year. In a report in September, he warned that the biggest potential problem of the ageing population that we have in this country is that it could lead to a slower pace of economic growth. And this approach is replicated across other governments, but also across other institutions. In 2007, when Facebook was plateauing at a mere 70 million users, it set up a dedicated team aimed solely at increasing the number of users. Today, Facebook has 2.27 billion users, more than any country in the world, and more akin to the size of a religion than anything else. So just to take a step back and look at how Facebook did this. So when Facebook was plateauing at 70 million users in 2007, the company got concerned. Were they going to be able to reach 100 million users? Were they going to get any bigger? Or was this it? Had they topped out at 70 million? And a growth team was set up to look at this issue across design, technology, and product. And the goal was purely to get bigger by using a methodological, evidence-based approach. And this wasn't just about setting up a number of small projects and then leaving it. This was integrated into how they did business. And Mark Zuckerberg described it as the most important thing that they did. And some of the things that they did, and there's a large number of them, but some of the things that they did were they introduced internet connectivity to parts of the world that didn't have it. They allowed users to implement new languages themselves rather than Facebook doing it, which means that it's now got more than 100 languages used to date. And they also introduced a contact importer, which we've all seen, so people can find their friends when they go into Facebook and widen their circle and see more of the people that they follow. And none of these steps on their own were key, but it was about doing it in aggregate. And they were hugely successful. Facebook hit 100 million in 2008. It's been growing ever since. And Facebook hasn't stopped growing. The growth team is an ongoing part of the business, and the team has been replicated across lots of other areas like Instagram and WhatsApp. And for many tech companies, having a growth team is now an integral part of their business. As we all know, as well as being one of the biggest companies in the world, Facebook is also one of the most loved and the most trusted. Except we all know that is not true. Facebook's problems have piled on in recent years, mainly around the spread of misinformation and how the company hasn't done enough to stem it. We saw this in the 2016 election when Russian interference led to the spread of what we now know as fake news. And Facebook has been trying to remedy this lack of trust. They've introduced a fact-checking program with a number of newsrooms throughout the world, including my own. And we saw that there was, in the recent US midterms, there was a a decrease in the amount of misinformation there compared to the presidential election. But these are small steps, and it's hard to turn back the tide. This all comes down to trust, and as Facebook got bigger, it lost people's trust along the way. Just one third of Irish people, 33%, say that they trust social media platforms and search engines, according to this year's Edelman Trust Barometer. And this lack of trust isn't just in Facebook. The same study found 35% of people say that they trust the government, which is a large percentage of people who don't. In the Keep the Recovery Going slogan in 2016, which I mentioned at the start, it showed the gulf between how the government saw the country and how the people living in it saw it. Fine Gael pointed to the metrics which showed that the country was getting back on track after the recession and that the economy was growing, and the electorate pointed to their quality of life. And this is the central problem with using growth as your key metric. It erodes trust, and there has to be more. We can't just assume that growth is automatically good, because that just often isn't the case, as we're seeing. And there has to be a better way of looking at whether a country or a business or a newsroom is doing well, instead of just assuming that getting bigger equates with success. So focusing on quantitative measures is good for business, but by ignoring qualitative measures, you're glossing over people's lived experiences, whether that's their use of a social network or living in a society. Numbers are subjective, and by choosing the metrics you want to pay attention, and you choose the metrics you want to pay attention to. As a country, we've decided to put a focus on GDP, but why is it that, and at the expense of what? Newsrooms have been learning this lesson, we still are, and it's about needing to keep people's trust as you grow. The growth of the internet has meant that the news has been unbundled. It used to be that people would buy one newspaper in the morning, we'd have listened to one radio station during the day, watch the news when they came home from work. Now it's more likely that people will read Twitter on their morning commute, maybe listen to a podcast at lunch, click into stories that their friends send them on WhatsApp or that they might see on Facebook during the day, and have the radio on in the background, and still watch the TV news because we're people of habit in Ireland and some things don't change. And that's great in a lot of ways, because it's democratised the news and it means that people are getting the news from more sources than before. But it also means that the good news has been lumped in with the bad news and the terrible news. And readers are expected to be media literate and filter them. We put this onto readers. We assume that they are able to be media literate. And so newsrooms have to fight to get their stories in front of their audience and to be the good news that people can see. And I don't mean good news as in positive news. I mean good news as in strong, original reporting. Getting clicks is more straightforward. There's a formula to it. We saw these examples in the US during the 2016 election of people setting up websites and being able to get huge traffic on Facebook by spreading fake news. So views can't be the only measure of success for newsrooms, because they just don't measure enough. In my own experience at the Journal, we learned a long time ago we can't just look at the number of people who come to the site every day as a metric for whether we're succeeding or not. It's the biggest news website in the country, but we also have to look at more meaningful measures to ensure that we're still going to be successful in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. Like, do our readers trust us? Would they recommend us to a friend? Are we doing our job and serving them strong stories? And if the answers aren't what we want them to be, what are we going to do about it? So more than anything else, I would suggest that this is a time when institutions, so countries, social media platforms, newsrooms, should not just be focusing on growth as a metric, but on more qualitative measures. Joseph Stiglitz said, if we have the wrong metrics, we will strive for the wrong things. If growth erodes trust, as I think it does, then institutions need to focus on more. So instead of just asking, are we getting bigger, some better questions for newsrooms would be, are we producing fair and accurate journalism? Do readers trust us? Better questions for social media platforms would be, are we tackling hate speech and misinformation, and are we helping to connect people? And for the programme for government, is this a fair country and is this an equal country? And are people getting the opportunities that they need to build a life? And once we've asked those questions, we need to look at how we measure these things. So I'm using what I've learned about metrics from newsrooms and looking at applying it to the way that Ireland looks at its own metrics, particularly economic growth. And so I'm taking a step back and looking at what exactly the next programme for government is trying to achieve and working from there. And instead of looking at growth, these institutions should also be looking at these other questions. Just want to take a step back to something I mentioned a moment ago about journalists not just caring about clicks, which people may have been kind of surprised at a little bit. For a long time, there was a perception that online journalism was all about how many readers would click into an article to view it. And it was a perception, but for a lot of news websites, it was also a reality. Page views and unique views, so the number of readers, were an established way of looking at success, in part because of the advertising industry. Commercial partners generally are happy with these straightforward and replicable metrics. In some ways, it was a replication of the business model of newspapers. You count how many people are buying your paper and seeing the ads in order to determine whether something is successful or not. And this has led to some bad journalism. It's easy to see what people can click into and what they're reading, and then tailor content and a business model accordingly. And that's why sites like, say, the Mail Online is one of the biggest sites in the world. But newsrooms need more. And some websites have begun rebelling against this confining approach, particularly in the last 5 years or so. And they've argued two things. Firstly, some newsrooms have argued that just focusing on the numbers doesn't take into account the number of readers, doesn't take into account the experience that readers are having when they read the news from a modern newsroom. Some readers may subscribe and read newsletters from a news website, for example, or listen to a podcast by its journalists, or follow its stories on Instagram or YouTube. In other words, as media has become more distributed, it's begun requiring an equally distributed solution for measuring its influence. BuzzFeed has got an interesting model as a way of counting its readers. Instead of just counting the number of readers who, or looking at the number of readers who open its app every day or read its stories, it also looks at the number of people who view its videos on YouTube or who like its images on Instagram or its stories on Snapchat. So it's not just about views, it's about people getting content where they are, where they're using the site on the internet. I'm not completely crazy about this because of the reliance on other platforms. These social media platforms are competitors to newsrooms. They're not our allies. And the goal should be about people's experience of news on your own site and not somewhere else. But the other problem, though, aside from views not taking into account where people get their news, is that just counting the number of readers as a purely quantitative measure ignores any kind of qualitative metric. And in this era, where distrust of the media has become so much more prevalent with the spread of misinformation, understanding the experience that readers value when reading their news online has become much more important. And we've seen this particularly in the UK with Brexit and in the US with Trump, but it's been spreading for a few years as the news has become unbundled. Ireland isn't as bad as other countries. We've got apparently 71% of Irish consumers trust most news, according to the Reuters Institute report on news released earlier this year. And that's higher than the EU average. But that's why we shouldn't be complacent about it. This is the exact time where Ireland needs to make sure that we're keeping this level of trust in the media. And the shift towards qualitative metrics means that newsrooms will still look at how many people read the website every day and week and month. But increasingly, they'll also look at how long readers are spending reading these articles, whether they're sharing these articles on Facebook or WhatsApp or Twitter, and how much of each article they actually read rather than just skim. So it's a move away from the idea that online audiences only want short, snappy, fast food when it comes to getting their news online and towards a more engaged approach. No news website wants someone clicking into a story once and never returning. That's not sustainable as a business model. Instead, you want to engage your audience. You want someone who clicks into your news website and is given a reason to stay and to return. So the problem with these qualitative measures that I'm talking about is that, much as with some of the alternatives to GDP, which I'll mention in a moment, it can make it difficult to compare news organisations. For example, the Irish Times has a number of excellent podcasts. The Journal does a couple of email newsletters. Other media outlets don't. How do you compare these newsrooms when the output is so different? And the answer for us has been to continue to use some replicable metrics that will allow us to compare ourselves to competitors, mainly for commercial reasons, but to also come up with metrics that are important to us and our values and make sure that we're achieving them. So in our coverage of the Eighth Amendment referendum earlier this year, our big approach to it was making sure that we were informing our readers. And our measure of success for that was if we were getting tweets and emails from readers saying, "Thank you, I appreciated that. It was unbiased reporting and it helped me to make up my mind." And that was all we looked for. We did something similar with the Disclosures Tribunal. Again, things that are not going to be massive, something that isn't going to be a commercial success in terms of coverage, but it was important to us and our values as a company. So these shows where a company's priorities are, and metrics should reflect what a company cares about. And for every media company, we should be looking at the data points that are relevant to its workings. And that brings us to the problem with GDP. In the same way that relying solely on views has been a problem for websites because it doesn't reflect the nuances of whether they're succeeding or not, relying solely on GDP is a similar problem for countries. I was at a press council event last month, which was discussing how the media covers minority communities in Ireland. You won't be surprised to know that the answer was not well. Mike Allen of Focus Ireland was speaking at it, and he was rightly critical of journalists and sub-editors for using photographs of rough sleepers to illustrate stories about homelessness in Ireland. And he pointed out that rough sleepers make up just over 100 out of the 10,000 homeless people in Ireland. And by using images of rough sleepers, readers will conceptualise homelessness in that way and as a result see the solution about being about that too. So the answer to homelessness becomes about providing emergency shelter for these rough sleepers instead of building and providing homes for people who are forced to live in emergency accommodation and homeless hubs. And Alan said this. And it's the same myopic issue with GDP. By focusing on one metric, a government will automatically work towards solutions that increase economic growth and eschew others which don't. When GDP was pioneered in the 1930s by economist Simon Kuznets, he cautioned against it being used as a measure of welfare in a country. But the replicability and the measurability of GDP has led to it being widely used for precisely the purpose of measuring welfare in a society. If a country has high GDP, we will say it's doing well, and vice versa. Low GDP means that we don't think it's doing well. And this is the main advantage offered by using GDP. It's a clean way to compare one country to another and to give an idea of the strength of each country's economy. It's been compared to a speedometer. It can tell you whether your economy is going fast or slow, but nothing about whether your economy is overheating or about to run out of fuel or even going in the right direction. And then there's this. The most obvious example of the problems with GDP came in July 2016 when we saw the figures for the Irish economy growing by 26.3% in the previous year in 2015, which is more than three times the expected rate, after a large number of multinationals switched their base to Ireland. Paul Krugman there, he described it as leprechaun economics. The Irish Times pragmatically noted that these changes were widely recognised as not reflecting changes to the real economy, which is something Paddy touched on in his last answer there. And this isn't to lay the blame on economists, because they merely come up with a figure. Michael Porter, who's an economist who came up with an alternative to using GDP as a metric, has said that GDP is not bad, it just measures what it measures. And like page views, what it measures is limited. It's politicians who decide the importance that is put on it and the policies that are put in place as a result of it. So it's worth looking at the questions that GDP overlooks, as proposed by economist Jennifer Blank, and highlight the gaps which could be provided for by focusing on other metrics, much like the questions from earlier on about what newsrooms and countries and social media platforms could be answering. Firstly, is economic growth fair? It's not just about how much is produced that matters, but how these gains are distributed. Does this growth translate into improvements in living standards across the society for the many and not for the few? Secondly, is economic growth green? Again, it's not about how much we produce and grow, but how we do it and the pressure that this puts on our natural environment. And thirdly, is the economic growth improving our lives? Consumers increasingly make use of businesses such as Airbnb and Spotify and Uber, where they can make more use of what already exists rather than simply producing more stuff. And these business models add economic and consumer value rather than quantity. So it's worth looking at other alternatives which could fill the gaps left by GDP and gross national income that the next government could be considering when it comes to helping shape its direction over the coming years. Earlier this year, Chris Moran, who's the former audience editor at The Guardian, came up with five characteristics for what makes for a good metric. He was talking about metrics for a newsroom, but they could equally be applied to the ones used by a country too. And the five were relevant, does it align with your core goals? Measurable, is it objective, can it be defined? Actionable, can you do something positive and impactful with the data? Reliable, is the metric technically robust and will it be relevant in a year? And readable, can it be easily misunderstood and does it require a lot of context? And by this measure, GDP ticks at least three out of the five boxes. And just adding to that, the New Economics Foundation in the UK has argued that indicators on how a country is doing need to matter to people, need to be clear and easy to communicate, and be far-reaching. So given that, a couple of metrics that Ireland could be looking at as an alternative or a complement to GDP. In 2014, Harvard economist Michael Porter unveiled the Social Progress Index, which is intended to act as a complement to GDP, measuring everything except economic growth. It looks at 51 social and environmental indicators that measure outcomes such as life expectancy and literacy and freedom of choice, rather than inputs such as the size of government spending. And Porter has said that it aims to capture the breadth of issues that constitute well-being and identify priority areas for improvement. So in its 2018 report, Ireland is ranked 12th out of 146 countries. You can see Norway came first, followed by Iceland and Switzerland, with Afghanistan and Chad as the lowest ranking countries on the index. Ireland scores highest on opportunity indicators, such as access to advanced education, but less well on health, environmental and infrastructural issues. So that the healthcare system is problematic will not come as a surprise to the public or politicians in Ireland, but using an index like the SPI would allow the government to benchmark achievements or lack of in trying to solve the healthcare problem, problems that wouldn't show up by just looking at the GDP figures. On a different scale, the New Economics Foundation in Britain has proposed looking at just five key indicators as a better indicator than GDP: good jobs, well-being, the environment, fairness, and health. And these factors, they argue, will tell if an economy is going in the right direction. So on the issue of good jobs, for example, they argued that the indicator says that everyone should be able to find secure, stable employment that pays at least enough to provide a decent standard of living. The New Economics Foundation found that 61% of the UK labour force had a secure job that paid at least the living wage, which meant that 39% didn't. Figures were designed for the UK, and there's no index showing how other countries compare, but the indicators are in principle just as meaningful and relevant for other countries as a way to gauge success. There's one thing that these two metrics and others like them have in common. They've not yet captured the public imagination and become used as everyday indicators, because it's hard to usurp a metric that's been around for more than 80 years. And yet Ireland has been at the forefront of a number of social changes in recent years, changes that aren't measured by conventional metrics. And there's no reason why Ireland can't also lead when it comes to implementing a change in how it measures success. One of the only qualitative indexes that has succeeded in entering the lexicon has been the Human Development Index, the 28-year-old metric which rolls together a country's GDP, the health of its citizens, and the education of its citizens. Ireland currently ranks fourth on the HDI behind Norway, Switzerland, and Australia. And if this is to be used as the sole alternative to GDP, the government might happily say that all is well. And this highlights the potential importance of the other measures identified in the Social Progress Index in helping guide government decisions. So, theoretically, if the government were to change its focus away from economic growth and prioritise more qualitative measures such as the ones mentioned above, what kind of policies could we expect to see stemming from that which don't currently exist? I'm going to speculate a little wildly here. But firstly, Ireland might consider a trial of basic income. When Mark Zuckerberg was giving the commencement speech at Harvard in May 2017, he spoke out in favour, in support of basic income. He said, "Every generation expands its definition of equality. Now it's time for our generation to define a new social contract. We should explore ideas like universal basic income to make sure everyone has a cushion to try new ideas." So with that speech, Zuckerberg became the most high profile of the band of tech entrepreneurs who have spoken out in favour of basic income. Unlikely allies of a massive social policy shift, perhaps, but for them, they're keenly aware that job insecurity is inescapable as many jobs become automated. And it's one perspective on a policy that has appeal across the political spectrum. For those on the left, it's a way to alleviate poverty and provide a support system for people in low-paid unemployment. For those on the right, it's a way to slash bureaucracy, replace it with a leaner welfare state. And for those in between, it's a way of reshaping the relationship that people have with the state. And the idea has been picking up traction in recent years. A 2016 poll across the EU found that 64% of people were in favour of basic income. So has its time finally come? Secondly, Ireland might look at increasing its carbon tax. Two big things happened on the 8th of October. A landmark report published by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change found that the immediate consequences of climate change are worse than previously thought, and that the world has just 12 years to act in order to limit the most devastating consequences. On the same day, just a few hours later, American economist William Nordhaus was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics, in part for coming up with the idea for a carbon tax. The very next day, in the announcement for Budget 2019, the Irish government didn't include an increase in carbon tax, despite having flagged in advance that it would be included. Leo Varadkar had told journalists at a briefing in August, "We will have to grasp the nettle in increasing the carbon tax." When he was asked why it hadn't been included in the budget, Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue said he had put a lot of thought into it, but come to the conclusion that it would have a significant impact on living standards and that he would not address it in this year's budget. Eamon Ryan, writing about this the next day, said that this was purely a political move, which was designed to appease more rural TDs and members of the Independent Alliance. And the issue here is that a carbon tax creates a market incentive to solve climate change. And any economist will tell you that's more powerful than expecting corporations and consumers to act out of a sense of altruism or moral responsibility or social responsibility, because it doesn't contribute to economic growth. On the contrary, it's more likely to penalise producers, but it creates a qualitatively better country in which to live. So why do we have this focus solely on GDP? It's become a feature in a lot of newsrooms nowadays to display a screen or several screens somewhere in the newsroom showing important traffic statistics. How many users are reading an article at any given time, for example, or what the most read articles on the site are. And whether it's explicit or not, the figures are a motivating force. Journalists are given the message that success will be recognised by having their work appear on the screen, and this may motivate the stories that they choose to write or not write and how they will write them. And in much the same way, the Irish government focuses on economic growth. And if this is a choice that the government has actively made, then so be it. But if it's done merely because it's the way that things have always been done, then it's ripe for change. And in the same way that newsrooms are striving to build trust and engage their newsrooms, the next programme for government could do worse than examining what metrics it wants to focus on and then working on its priorities based on that. So that's me. I'd like to say thanks to Social Justice Ireland for having me. I studied social policy in college, and the works of Sean Healy and Bridget Reynolds really helped to shape my worldview an awful lot. When Sean asked me to speak at this, we were talking on the phone, and I said to him very earnestly, "Sean, are you asking me to do this as a young person?" And he laughed. Thank you. And he laughed for I would say 5 seconds down the phone at me. And very gently he said, no, Christine, no, that's not it. And that's what it sounds like when your youth has ended, when someone laughs at the suggestion that you're a young person, if anyone is concerned about that. But it made me think about what my perspective is. And for me, I see things very much through the view of someone who's worked in a newsroom for a long time, as a woman in her 30s, as someone who's lived in Dublin for most of their life. And this is what I think is the most effective thing that we could be doing in this country to bring about actual change, to take the step back and to look at how we measure things and make the changes based on that. So it's been a real honour. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening. We hope you found this podcast useful. Check back here for more episodes soon.